You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston, tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday. Where are we now? The 9th of March. My name is Jemima and I'm your host and I'll be with you for the hour. Lyric is here today producing. How are you going?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Yeah, awesome. We've also got Jade who's been producing some work from home as well, so you'll be hearing from her, but from a distance today. If I Akine, coming up on the show today, Lyric speaks to Sandra Murray from Make It Legal New Zealand about a new poll released today regarding the cannabis referendum, which has shown an overwhelming 69% of respondents preferred legalisation over decriminalisation of cannabis. I talked to Neil Ballantyne, an organiser of Diverse Church New Zealand's Awaken 2021 conference, about the conference and why it creates a safe space for queer Christians to discuss the issues facing them. Jade looks into the attitudes surrounding the COVID-19 vaccination at universities in the United States. She speaks to a recently vaccinated residential advisor from Duke University, as well as an expert on vaccinations. He aho whakaro. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So, tuku pātui mai, you can send us through a text on 5395. Wai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. We're here. We love listening to what you've got to say, your thoughts on the day or the pieces that we've done today, so let us know. Also, after the show, koe e wariwari e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, he pakihiri rokiroki marunga i te pai tukutuku o Irarangi Poho. Mi haere ki 95 BFM Irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95 BFM website, 95bfm.com, underneath the Becasts page, on the right of the page if you want to know exactly where it is. But yeah, we post everything that goes up on The Wire there. If you miss bits of it and you want to go back and check it out, or if there's something, or if you missed a Wire show earlier in the week and you want to hear what we got up to. But anyway, it's a good show. It's a good day. It's Tuesday. We're in level two. So nice to have everybody back. So I hope you enjoy the show today.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
I spoke with Sandra Murray from Make It Legal NZ about a new poll published by the Helen Clark Foundation this morning. The poll took 833 people who had voted in last year's referendum and revealed an overwhelming 69% of respondents preferred legalisation or decriminalisation over total criminalisation. I talked to Sandra about why some people might choose decriminalisation over legalisation, the government's communication around the cannabis bill, and corporate harm. While these poll figures must be really reaffirming for what you've been campaigning for, is there also some frustration there?
Yes, I suppose so. The option of decriminalisation does not address any of the issues around supply. At the moment, the illegal supply of cannabis is coming from organised crime, largely. And all of the problems that are associated with that, in terms of you don't know what you're buying, you don't know how strong it is, you don't know what the quality is, you don't know what it's been sprayed with. And in some cases, people have to deal with suppliers who perhaps are people they might not want to have to interact with. It might not be safe to interact with them. So decriminalisation does not stop any of that side of the cannabis issue. And so it is a bit frustrating that during the referendum we weren't able to have that side of things adequately communicated, that people didn't understand actually what decriminalisation was and they didn't understand what legalisation was.
So what are the basic differences between decriminalisation and legalisation of cannabis?
So decriminalisation is really just focusing on the user, on the person who uses the cannabis, in that it takes away the criminal penalty if they are caught with it. It does nothing to address supply at all. It does nothing to address how cannabis is grown, how it is sold, how it is regulated for safety. It has none of that side of it. So it's in some ways it's a bit of a head in the sand way of doing things. It's my nice, you know, middle class teenage son won't get a criminal conviction. That's all I care about. I don't care about any of the crime or the safety issues that might occur from supply.
So what do you think people are considering when they're taking decriminalisation rather than legalisation?
We've had a very, very long time of light, extremely light regulation of alcohol and then in the past tobacco. And so people have this fear of corporate. And what they are saying when they say they want decriminalisation, not legalisation, is they're saying, we don't want big multinational companies coming over here setting up another harmful industry like they have for alcohol, tobacco, even gambling. That's what people are saying, is that they fear that our government will not actually introduce regulation to control those international corporations. They didn't understand, because it was a big bill, they didn't understand that the cannabis bill that we voted on was actually very good at restraining those big companies and was quite a good model for stopping the what they would have called big cannabis coming in. So that's what people were voting on. They're voting based on their fear of corporate harm.
Is there research to support people's fear of corporate harm?
Well, yes, you just have to look at alcohol, tobacco and gambling to see the harm. Even just this week, we've had articles in the newspapers about the alcohol industry advertising, totally ignoring advertising standards, you know, putting advertising up in front of schools. Everyone has seen alcohol companies push alcohol in outrageous ways. Councils have tried to bring in local alcohol regulations and been taken to court by alcohol companies. The behaviour of alcohol and gambling and tobacco companies justifies a concern, and what people are fearing is that if we introduce cannabis as well with a legal regulated market, those same problems will arise. But the problem with those industries is that the regulation on them is extremely light, whereas the regulation that we were proposing for cannabis would have been a model that we could have then later applied to cannabis and tobacco and possibly gambling.
So what do you think has changed in cannabis education from the time of the election campaign to now?
Nothing. Nothing's changed. It's been very quiet. Those views would have been were apparent throughout the referendum. Consistently, we were, you know, managing around 30,000 comments on our Facebook page every week, and what we were consistently seeing is people saying, I support decriminalisation, I'm not going to support the bill because I don't want corporate to come over and take over this industry and create another harmful industry. Came through quite strongly throughout the entire referendum campaign. So nothing has changed. It's those attitudes were prevalent then as they are now.
Is there any change you would like to see in conversations politicians and the media are having about cannabis legalisation?
I think the change that we need to see is that this government needs to recognise that there is a high-level support for further law reform in this area, and it is simply not acceptable for them to dismiss the views of the large number of people who supported legalisation at the referendum and the large number of people who also support decriminalisation. It is cowardly of them to simply try to brush this under the mat after such a large referendum support level. They need to change and actually have that conversation and amend the bill to something that people can accept and put it through to select committee where people can have proper discussion. It's that select committee that people can discuss the details. And in the referendum, people had no opportunity to discuss the details.
After the election, our Prime Minister publicly announced that she had voted in support of cannabis, despite staying neutral during her campaign. How much change do you think we would have seen in our referendum results if she had spoken up during the campaign process?
Personally, I don't think that was a big thing. I don't think there would have been that many people whose vote would have changed depending on what Jacinda Ardern was going to vote. I don't think that was the problem. I think the bigger issue here is the fact that throughout the entire referendum campaign, the government, Andrew Little, Jacinda Ardern and the other ministers, were so hands-off that they actually failed to provide adequate information and understanding to the general public about the bill that they had put forward. And they put the bill forward so late, a real scrabble for unfunded community organisations to then do the government's work to communicate a very complex, very long bill to public during a global pandemic. I think that the government simply failed to actually enact the referendum to a standard that the people of New Zealand would have expected.
Do you think this was a conscious decision?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it was absolutely a political decision in that the numbers were not clearly enough in their favour to justify them burning any political capital. And remember as well that the lobbyists, the alcohol, the pharmaceutical industry and other lobbyists are very much opposed to cannabis legalisation, because in every country in the world where cannabis has been legalised or decriminalised, both opiate use for medical purposes and alcohol use has declined significantly. Cannabis is a substitute for those. You will use cannabis instead of opiate to manage your low-level pain. You will use cannabis instead of drinking alcohol in high levels. Those very powerful lobby groups are utterly opposed to legalisation because it impacts their businesses. So I think that is an area that was completely ignored throughout the referendum, is who supported the status quo. And it was sold to us that it was moralistic church groups that supported the status quo, and the media failed to adequately investigate the support for the status quo from some of the largest, most powerful lobby groups on the planet.
Are there any final comments you want to make regarding legalisation of cannabis?
Well, this issue is not going to go away. People haven't stopped using cannabis because the referendum was lost. It's obviously it's going to have to come up again. And if you look at all around the world, it's almost every week that another country legalises cannabis. So we're increasingly just sort of starting to look quite quaint and behind the times. You know, so, I mean, just bite the bullet and deal with it. Everyone knows what needs to be done. Why the mucking around? Just do it.
That was Sandra Murray from Make It Legal NZ.
Thank you so much, Lyric. We will be right back after a little break. Here is Gold Sounds by Pavement. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM with Jemima and Lyric.
Go back to those gold sounds and keep my advent to yourself, because it's nothing I don't like. Is it a crisis or a boring change when it's central, so essential? It has a nice ring when you laugh at the low-life opinions, and they're coming to the chorus now. I keep my address.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM. If you want to text in anything you've got to say about the last piece or any piece coming up later in the hour, you can text us on 5395. Anyway, our next piece.
Diverse Church New Zealand is holding Awaken 2021, a rainbow faith gathering, at the end of this month. Diverse Church New Zealand is a rainbow Christian network that provides a space for connection between people who are part of both the LGBTQI+ and the Christian communities. Awaken 2021 is a hui that aims to connect and empower queer people of faith, as well as bridge the complicated divide between faith and the rainbow community in New Zealand. Around 100 people will attend the event. The recent Level 3 lockdown in Auckland and the shift to Level 2 across the rest of the country has impacted the turnout, according to organisers. I spoke to Neil Ballantyne, who is part of the organising committee for Awaken 2021, about the event. We discussed the issues facing queer Christian people today, how change can happen widely across the different denominations of the Christian faith, and why it is important to have a space like Awaken to connect with people with similar lived experiences. We also touch on the call to ban conversion therapy, which has been a significant policy issue this Pride Month. Neil speaks about why the government's move to ban the practice is so important for the rainbow Christian community. I began by asking Neil to explain the conference and what it will involve.
Yeah, sure thing. So Awaken is a project of a Diverse Church New Zealand, and this is the third time that we've had a national hui. So that's essentially what Awaken is. The first two were in Auckland, and are 2 years apart, and this is the first time that we're bringing it to Wellington. And so we're quite excited by that and by the opportunity to kind of, I guess, link the political dimensions of our identities and our lives with what's happening within government at the moment. So making that connection in the capital. But essentially what Awaken is an opportunity for rainbow Christians of faith to gather together, to fellowship together, to meet each other, because often we feel kind of isolated in our own church communities. We kind of feel like we might be the only gay in the village sometimes within our churches. And so to have a space that's safe for us to just hang out and have deep and meaningful conversations and celebrate who we are and what we are.
Could you speak to what some of the core issues facing queer Christians today are and whether they'll be a focus at the Awaken conference this year?
I guess in general, churches in New Zealand are still struggling with the idea of, you know, diverse sexualities and gender identities. It's kind of an ongoing dialogue within churches about how to recognise our lives and what kind of rights we're allowed. For example, I belong to the Anglican Church, part of a progressive Anglican church here in Wellington called St Peter's. And even though our denomination is probably one of the most progressive in the country, we still don't have same-sex marriage, for example, allowed within Anglican churches in Aotearoa, New Zealand. So that sort of shows how slow progress is within churches of recognising and honouring diverse sexualities and gender identities. But really, this conference, we're sort of trying not to focus too much on the negative stuff, because it's the negative stuff that we live with a lot. And so we're really sort of trying to focus on the positive stuff. We're trying to celebrate who we are, celebrate our lives, and allow spaces for us to come together and to support each other within our faith. And so with that, our official opening is going to be in Parliament, which is quite exciting. We're being hosted by the Deputy Prime Minister, Grant Robertson. We're having a series of speeches and welcome, drinks and nibbles and that kind of thing. And following that, we're going to tour the Rainbow Room, which is one of the select committees in Parliament, which is honouring of the rainbow community. And then for the next 2 days of the conference, which will be based at St Peter's, we have a range of activities that are going to happen. We have three fantastic keynotes, including Elizabeth Kitty, who, of course, is a new Member of Parliament for the Green Party, but is also an incredible scholar in terms of takatāpoi, Māori Indigenous gender and sexual identity. And then we have workshops that cover everything from exploring queer Christian sex ethics through to reading the Bible with a queer lens, through to gender diversity and a whole bunch of things in between. So it should be a great time.
So I've got a couple of questions based off what you just said. Going back to the beginning, you talked about how your church is reasonably progressive compared to perhaps other churches. Obviously, within Diverse Church New Zealand, you have a whole group of people coming from different denominations. Is it difficult to make change across a number of different churches and be able to sort of watch progression happen altogether?
Definitely you've recognised one of the complexities of making change is that there is so many, as I sort of call it, flavours of Christianity, and these have come about through various splits at various times of history and for various sort of doctrinal reasons, and basically everyone thinking that they had a slightly different truth and that their truth was slightly better. And so, of course, that makes change complicated when you're seeing it at that kind of meta level. And so it has to happen from within, really. It has to happen sort of at that individual denominational basis. And with our Anglican Church, you know, that's been happening. You know, this conversation has been going on for 30, 40, 50 years, and we're still not at the point where we've allowed for same-sex marriage. We've got this thing called blessings, which is kind of like a compromise, but not actually allowing for a marriage yet. So, yeah, it's slow. It's a little bit painful, to be honest, and you're sort of having conversations which, you know, feel like the sort of things we're discussing as a society 20 years ago doesn't feel very relevant in the 21st century. But at the same time, it is important because, A, it's important for, you know, young queer Christian kids as they're growing up, especially if they're growing up in families which are a bit more traditional. This change is so important to protect them and keep them safe as they're trying to figure out who they are. But it's actually also important for the churches too, because if churches want to be relevant to the 21st century, if they want young people to come to them and explore faith, then they're going to have to be relevant. They're going to have to understand that actually homophobia and transphobia is no longer, you know, acceptable within our society.
I just want to move on to the conversion therapy issue now. The issue of banning conversion therapy has been a significant issue this month, with the Labor government promising to ban conversion therapy but not necessarily taking quick action, and the Green Party also seeking public support for banning the practice via their online petition. Are you able to speak to the significance of this issue and call for making conversion therapy illegal?
Yeah, it's a fascinating one, eh? Because I think when these sort of discussions really hit the media and people started seeing that this push was, you know, had quite a lot of support, I think a lot of people were wondering, really? Is this stuff really still happening? It seems so, you know, 1950s, old school, barbaric kind of stuff. And certainly the answer is yes, because of the way churches kind of see the world. Basically, they view diverse sexualities and gender identity as just so wrong that they can't be natural, and therefore they must be able to be changed. And so what that generally looks like is someone going along and seeing a so-called Christian counsellor, who may or may not be qualified in any way, shape or form, and going through some kind of talking therapy is usually how it kind of operates. But although that doesn't seem perhaps as harsh as some of the, you know, more medicalized stuff we might have seen in the 1950s, it still brings with it all sorts of shame and issues of self-confidence and, you know, sort of identity development and that kind of stuff that can be really messed up when people are put under all this pressure, especially as young people. And so it is, from that perspective, a very harmful practice. Fortunately, I never underwent it myself, although I certainly was offered it when I came out when I was in my early 20s and in a fairly conservative church in Dunedin. I was sort of told to go away and get some Christian counselling, and I was going to sort myself out, apparently. But it was at that point that I decided that was not the place for me and that I needed to move on. So it's definitely out and about, definitely still a thing in New Zealand. And I think banning it is a very important step to, again, protecting those young, vulnerable, queer Christian kids. It's not going to be simple. This stuff comes with all kinds of awkward free speech and freedom of religion arguments that get very messy, because this stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum, right? It happens because of overlays of religious kind of guilt and shame and all that kind of stuff. And so that kind of stuff is hard to kind of tease out. I appreciate the Green Party's petition, which has encouraged the Labor government to move a bit faster on this. I mean, it has been something that's been in the election manifesto, but I think it has certainly sped up the timeframes, which is great. So now it's up to the Ministry of Justice to write some good legislation.
Talking a little bit about the government, you know, making the step to banning conversion therapy, do you feel as though the government is doing enough? The Prime Minister has said that the sort of longer timeframe towards the end of the year placed around introducing legislation is because the government wants to get it right and make the positive impact they need to have. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do actually think that a longer time frame is completely valid. Like I say, this will be quite complex legislation to try and craft and to try and balance those different rights that we value as a society. So I think that's cool. But I think, yeah, I think the fact that it's going to happen this year is actually quite fantastic. It's been a long time coming, and we're definitely ready for it. But at the same time, yeah, what it looks like, you know, the devil's in the detail, as they say. What it looks like is going to be interesting to explore. And, of course, we should get the opportunity to have our say through the Select Committee process as well to sort of factor into that.
And what are your thoughts on the National Party not having a position at all on the practice?
Yeah, that's just lazy, really, isn't it? I think they realise that their core voting base is reasonably conservative and probably don't necessarily want the legislation, but they also realise that as soon as they say that, they're going to get leapt on by, you know, the majority of New Zealanders who do want that legislation. So I understand they're between a rock and a hard place, but yeah, they should know what's right.
And just finally, I just want to take it back to the conference, take it back to Diverse Church New Zealand and ask you, why is it important for a space like this to be provided to Rainbow Christian people?
Yeah, I mean, the sad fact is that most rainbow folk who grow up within a Christian environment do receive so much discrimination and feel so uncomfortable they generally leave the church. And so what we're doing is providing a space that says actually it is possible to be queer and Christian, and it's not just possible, but it's actually, you know, it's fantastic. It's a great way to be because, you know, we believe at the heart of Jesus' message was a message of love and acceptance and grace and justice, and all that stuff is totally aligned with the Rainbow community. So the judgment and the shame and all that stuff we don't believe is core to the Christian message at all, and we think that the churches need to move through that. So we provide a space both for, yeah, supporting the queer Christian community, but we also provide, I guess, a voice back to the church saying, you guys can do better. You know, you can do better than this. The core of the Christian message is not what this is about. So, yeah, let's do better.
I then asked Neil if he had anything to add on the details of the conference.
Okay. One thing I would like to let your listeners know is that due to a generous donor, we have some funding available for scholarships. So especially if there's anyone in Auckland who is looking to come down but are worried about the financial burden of that, please do get in touch with us and we'll see what we can make work.
That was Neil Ballantyne, an organiser of Diverse New Zealand's Awaken 2021 conference, which aims to connect those who identify as part of the LGBTQI+ community and the Christian faith. The conference will be opened on Friday 26th of March at the Parliament Buildings in Wellington at 7 p.m. and will then run for 2 days at St. Peter's Anglican Church and also on Saturday the 27th and Sunday the 28th of March. If you're interested, you can head to the events page at diversechurch.co.nz.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima and I have a piece from Jade who has been producing from home today. Jade talked to the US-based Duke University student resident advisor, Daniel Sprague, about his recent COVID-19 vaccination and about Duke University's response and student attitude towards COVID-19 and self-managed distancing and isolation.
When did you get the vaccine and what was the process like to apply for one?
So I got the vaccine this past Friday. The process was a little weird. Here, like, everything is, like, super, super decentralized. So, like, I was recently in my state, North Carolina, like, you basically just like apply through a bunch of different like health systems, and then if they have appointments available, then they'll let you sign up. So like, I didn't think I was going to be able to like sign up for a while because I know appointment times have been limited, but I just went to this one like website that my friend sent me, which is for like the county next to my county, and then they just somehow happened to have a lot of empty slots, and so I was able to sign up through that and get it.
So was there any correlation with you being an RA for the university?
So that was what made me like eligible to get the vaccine, but there was no association between like my job and like the process by which I like applied and like got the appointment. Yeah.
So who's eligible right now?
It like basically completely depends on what state you're in. Here, like in North Carolina, they just opened it up to like what they call frontline essential workers, which like includes like university staff and like instructors, and then also includes like food service workers and like a bunch of other categories designated like frontline essential workers, plus like people over 65, and then people who like work in healthcare, and people who like have underlying health conditions.
Okay, so you go to Duke University, and I'm kind of wondering about the culture there and what it's like. Do a lot of people like seem to want to get vaccinated? And I guess since it's not through the university, it's kind of different, but does it seem like all the staff and workers are getting vaccinated?
Yeah, so I think that like it does seem like pretty much everyone is really trying to get it, and like if they're able to, like they will get it. I know a lot of people have been volunteering to the like vaccine clinics, because sometimes if they have extra doses at the end of the day, then they'll just like vaccinate the volunteers. But it seems like Duke has done a pretty good job of like the people who are eligible like get it fairly quickly. Like I think right now, like all of the instructors, like all of the professors who are like teaching in person have gotten vaccinated, and they're working on like the dining staff. One of my friends who works in like a research lab on campus, he just got scheduled to get vaccinated on Wednesday.
So the pandemic has been going on like for a while now, over a year, and I'm assuming students have been like getting potentially more and more reckless because you guys haven't had similar lockdowns to New Zealand. Would you say like students are less inclined to self-isolate now?
Yeah, so I think it kind of depends. Like I think there are some students who like won't, like who like literally will not see anyone except like outside and with the mask, and who are being very safe and careful. And then I also know that there's a lot of other students who are like flying, traveling, like literally going to clubs, like going to like 50 plus person parties and whatnot. And then you have like everyone kind of in between. So I think what's been really hard is because there's like not really been this like top down structure of like regulations and like recommendations and like restrictions like they've had in New Zealand. I think it's just like basically every person just has to determine for themselves like what they're okay with and what they're willing to do.
So what has Duke done at all? They haven't come up with any rules or regulations regarding COVID and mask wearing and stuff like that?
Well, so like on campus, like you have to wear masks like everywhere, and like they've definitely limited like a lot of the like outdoor eating spaces, and like they have like a really robust like contact tracing and like testing system like for Duke students. But like, I think the hard part is like, you know, they can't control who you hang out with, or like they can't control like people living off campus and that kind of stuff. So like, even if like they try to enforce it, but like there's only so much that they can do.
Yeah. So finally, do you think the university culture will look very different post everyone being vaccinated, or as many people as possible?
I mean, the school year will basically be over, like, when that time comes. So I think that a lot of people are kind of hoping that if vaccines are really ramping up in the next month, then at least the last maybe few weeks of the year will be like not normal, but like, you know, we can see people and like, you know, see people in ways that we haven't been able to like recently and like feel relatively safe about it. So like, I think people are like really, really anxious and like itching to have things return back to normal, at least for a little bit. But we'll see. It really just depends on how quickly the vaccines ramp up.
That was US-based Duke University student Daniel Sprague discussing his recent COVID-19 vaccination and Duke University's attitude and support towards COVID-19 and the vaccination of it. Next, Jade talked to Duke University Associate Professor of Medicine, Dr. Cameron Robert Wolfe, who is in charge of Duke's COVID-19 response. They discussed how Duke University has handled the COVID-19 pandemic as North Carolina has begun its phase of vaccinating university staff.
What has Duke's COVID-19 response looked like so far, and has it changed since the start of the pandemic?
Yeah, it's changed a lot. It's a detailed question. 13 or 14 months ago, we realized we might have had some unique exposure because we actually have a shared university relationship with the University of Wuhan, and in fact have a campus in China where we send students to and from. So we kind of, I think, felt the wrath of this early on in our adjustments and closing of our Chinese campus. But at least here domestically, North Carolina at least did not bear the burden of the worst of the sort of the start of the outbreak. And so we had a couple of extra months, I would say, compared to, say, New York or Northern Italy, to prepare our hospital and think about the way the university would be impacted. But it still got busy here. I mean, to put it in context, we had at one point 210 people in our hospital in January sick with COVID, which is, a fifth of the hospital was people who had respiratory, you know, COVID pneumonia. I think that's probably more than I've ever been in the hospital in the entirety of New Zealand, if I read the statistics correct. So it certainly hit us hard, and I guess we've done a lot of sort of systematic adjustments to the way the hospital runs, the way the students come back on campus, the way we do a lot of stuff virtually now, the way we all wear masks universally on the buildings, and have been doing so for 9 months. Lots of little subtle adjustments, yeah. I could go into different bits as you need.
Yeah, so what is actually mandated? Are masks mandatory for students and staff?
So they are here, yeah. So we've had mandatory masks on campus, and in fact it's been a statewide mask mandate here for quite some time. What that amounts to is that there's really any public space that's not within your own home has a mask mandate across the whole state. For a long time the state had a curfew beyond 10 p.m., and for at least on the university side, that's also meant additional sort of safety measures such as no large gathering, no sort of formal conferences or meetings. They're all done virtually. Patients are allowed one visitor only and none onto the COVID service, which is obviously really challenging for sick individuals not to have visitors. And, lots of adjustments to our restaurants and cafeterias and meal services on the university side. Lots of those sorts of things are different.
So is there kind of social distancing measures as well in the classroom and in the cafeterias?
Yeah, I mean, most of the classrooms are all virtual. So there are some that still take in-person classes. It's often professor-dependent. But even when they do, they're usually with reduced size. We've had quite intentional sort of de-densification measures in the dormitories to reduce the number of people there. And, you know, quite typical for most American universities, often, you know, campuses in your first freshman year would be split rooms where you share with someone else. We took all those away, and so everyone's had their own room, their own space if they were still on campus. Yeah, lots of adjustments to try and introduce space for sure wherever you work.
Yeah, it's definitely really different because in New Zealand, our response is basically a nationwide effort of enforced lockdowns. So obviously, if there's one community case in Auckland, all universities and businesses are closed and mandatory online classes are enforced. So what does it look like if students or staff at Duke get COVID-19 or have symptoms of it?
Yeah, I mean, to reflect back on your first comment, I mean, the big difference here is that we don't have the level of central control and sort of ability to regulate in the way that New Zealand or Australia does, and that's to your huge advantage when it comes to an infectious disease like this. So, you know, for us here, the university can certainly drive its own internal policies to try and keep COVID out, so to speak, or to minimize its transmission. So the kind of things that we do is we have a surveillance program in place that randomly once or twice a week brings everyone in for COVID testing. We recognized pretty early on, and I think have been supported by data to say that lots of students can be asymptomatically infectious to people around them and not know. So the only way you really cut transmission down is to proactively test people around the clock if there's plenty of community transmission as we've had. So not only do students get tested on a regular basis, but they also, you know, if there's someone who's positive, we have special isolation dormitories where they can be cared for and be separated away from the rest of the general community. We also have a large workforce who do contact tracing on the campus. You know, you guys are probably familiar with contact tracing that's typically done in New Zealand or Australia through the departments of public health. Here, I think the challenge was that there was just such a swath of cases that we can't rely on the local Department of Health to have enough staff to literally contact trace as much as we would need to, so we do it ourselves under their sort of under their jurisdiction. And so we have a separate set of dormitories available for students who cannot quarantine in a safe space. So if you live in your own house, for example, and you can quarantine there, we're fine with that. But if you don't have a space where you can do that, then we set up quarantine bays in some of our local dormitories or hotels to accommodate students accordingly. At least feel as if we're doing the right thing to keep them safe and keep them out of the way of transmitting to others.
So finally, would you say there's an overall attitude that you have observed the students and staff taking towards COVID-19 isolation and initiatives, or is it more of a person-by-person decision?
You know, I think for us, we were really lucky in the fall semester, so the last half of 2020, I think most students viewed this as a real opportunity and a privilege, I hope, to feel like they can be back on campus, because there were many campuses across the country, as you probably know, that closed down altogether and made everything 100% virtual. And yet we've always thought that there was a real positive learning experience from being still on a campus. And I actually think most students kind of viewed it as, look, you know, as almost a challenge to make this work. And if you do it in a sort of a non-draconian way, I think people can understand that, you know, these are the things that we have to do in order to maintain the student life that we look forward to. Similarly, from the teaching side of things, I've always thought people learn better if in a university environment, not sort of doing it from a Zoom background. And so, you know, I think the challenge was equally there for all the professors to say, hey, let's make this work. So generally, it was actually pretty positive, and I think we worked hard to encourage that sort of teamwork perspective. Now, that's hard because it's clearly not the complete typical North American university experience. Like, we had to be, you know, quite active in curtailing a lot of the sorority and fraternity activities that would otherwise involve large congregate sort of events. They haven't occurred, and some of our athletic facilities and activities, for example, have not had crowds, which was a big thing for Duke sports traditionally. So it certainly doesn't feel like 2019 normal, but I think students were aware that you know, if they work hard and we work hard, they can still have a good campus experience and get a great education out of it. So it's worked so far.
That was Duke University Associate Professor of Medicine and COVID-19 Response Director, Dr. Cameron Robert Wolfe, on the university's response to COVID-19 as staff vaccinations have begun rolling out into the university in the States. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. We will be right back after a little break. Here is Circle the Drain, the Unknown Mortal Orchestra remix by Soccer Mommy.
Truck just crashed through the flipping wall. There goes the bond.
Anyone for tacos?
Couldn't we just order online?
I mean, yeah, you could, but the atmosphere, man.
The Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit. Everything you need to make authentic, delicious tacos at your place. Get them from Faro Fresh or order online at theluckytaco.co.nz for free delivery anywhere Auckland-wide. The Lucky Taco, bringing Mexican street food to your place since way back.
The Billboard Hot 100.
Pitchfork's top 200 songs of the 1990s.
The Rock 2000.
All of them little piss babies, unable to compare to the one show, the only show, with the guff to shove it to the man at his house where he lives.
The 95BFM Top 10. The best show, the best songs, the best hosts. Annabelle and Callum, taking you through the best radio station in the world's toppest top tracks of the week.
The 95BFM Top 10, 7 to 9pm every Wednesday.
Vote online at 95bfm.com/vote.
That was The Wire.
That was the Tuesday Wire for another week. Thank you very much who spoke with us. Thank you very much to whoever spoke with us for the show today. Thank you very much to you for tuning in and listening to us. Thank you very much, Lyric and Jade, for being wonderful producers as always. Do you have anything to say about the show, Lyric?
I had a good show today. It was really easy, seamless.
Well, yeah.
For me, at least.
We love that. We love an easy, seamless wire, because some days it can be definitely a little stressful. Yeah. Oh, well, we hope you have a wonderful day out there and that you enjoy the slightly overcast day. But, you know, have fun out there. Look after yourselves and remember to keep scanning in and wearing your mask if you're on public transport and washing your hands. Stay safe. Look after yourself. Up next is Jin with the 1-4 and we will catch you next time.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.